Thank you. Hello, everyone. I'm Dennis Nance, and I'm an alcoholic. Man, it's great to be back in the state of Georgia. I want to thank Lynn, Marge, and Betsy for inviting us back to the state of Georgia and here for the first time and making us feel so welcome. And I've met a lot of friends, old friends, since I've been here. Some people I remember, some I did remember. You know, it's good to see you again. It's also good to have my lovely wife with me, Libra. Stand up, Libra. Where's Libra? There she is. Here she is. She usually accompanies me everywhere I go. You know, there are several things that every drunk needs. Must have some bounce checks, at least one DWI, and a lot of other things. If you're real good, God will give you your very own Al-Anon. You know? So I have mine. You know, when you're as cool as I am, you try to do things that look masculine. And Betsy pinned me with the boutonniere. And I'm still cool. I've got the boot in a lot of other places, but I have it here today. Anyway, you know, I don't know anything new. I don't have anything profound to say, except that I hadn't been this nervous in a long time. I don't know why that is, but I'm just nervous tonight. But you know, it's good to be back here. It's good to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I kind of like, and I needed to get away from work. And there's no place that I'd rather be than in Atlanta, Georgia, on a good old hot liquor drinking Thursday night. That's exactly where I'm supposed to be. And, so I guess I'm in the right place. It's my belief. It's my belief that that I am sober through the grace of a loving God who manifests himself in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe there is a difference in the fellowship and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the God of my understanding also manifests himself in an ever-widening and an ever-growing circle of friends like yourself. And that circle seems to get bigger and better. Every time I do the things that Alcoholics Anonymous suggest I do, it seems to get bigger and better. When I share with you, but more than that, when I allow you to share with me, you'll see I need to grow too. See, the people that have the type of sobriety that I want to develop, that I hope to achieve a day at a time, are people who do those things that Alcoholics Anonymous ask them to do. I think I've been blessed, not just fortunate, but blessed in that way. I am also blessed to have gotten sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I didn't always like that. When I came around, there were some old guys that sat in the back of the room. And it seems like they had been sober so long, I didn't even believe they ever drank liquor, you know? And the meeting was small, you see. I'm very self-conscious, and I like to hide in big groups. And these guys always sit at the back of the meeting. And that it was on Paisley Street in Greensboro. And this wall, the wall had that old cheap epoxy paint on it. And these guys had been sober so long that they had little brown spots where their head had been against that paint. You know, you could, if one was missing, you see a spot. And they had those one-syllable names like Slick and Stick and Bob. I guess maybe one time they drunk so much they couldn't remember their whole name, you know. But I didn't like them. I didn't think they liked me. I realized sometime later on that they loved me more than I ever knew. And see, that's the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had never been loved like this before. I had always been in a position where I could scare people and intimidate people and keep them from telling me the truth about me. But these people loved me enough to tell me the truth. And I hated them for it. And the meeting would start. And the chairman would open the meeting like Lynn did. And these old guys would start nodding off one by one. By the time they read the thought for the day, some of them were just all out sleeping, snoring. You know? And they would appear to sleep until it came my time to share. And I'd say something to them, and all of them would wake up at the same time. And start asking me all those questions that I didn't know the right answers to. I said, "Boy, who told you that?" "Nobody tell me that. When I was smart, I got here. I thought my own stuff up, you know." Then they say, "Can you find that in the big book?" "I didn't have a big book." "What do you need a big book for if you're not going to follow the instructions?" Then they'd ask you the third question. "Who's your sponsor?" "Didn't have one." And they begin to share with me things that I really didn't care for. And I begin to adapt some of their opinions. See, all these guys had opinions. They'd expound these opinions. They had wisdom, just infinite wisdom. They'd say things that I didn't understand. And one of the things they said, used to say, is, "Boy, if this program ain't working around this your kitchen table, it ain't working around this AA table." It took me a long time to figure that one out. You know, I was just slow. One thing, you know, they always had a spokesman. And the spokesman was A.D., who later became my sponsor. And A.D. came up one night and said, "Boy, we've diagnosed your problem." You see, I knew it was different. And he said, "You're suffering from malnutrition between the ears. You need some therapy." You know, it took me about 2 weeks to figure that one out. I showed up sometime later with my best friend. I said, "I'll be that guy calling me dumb." He said, "But Dennis, that was two weeks ago." I said, "Well, I need a little time to think about it." But I realize now that these guys had insight that I didn't have. And see, it was obvious to them that I was on that merry-go-round. And see, I'd reached that point in my illness that the only way I thought I could feel good is by picking up the very thing that made me feel bad. The only way I thought I could solve my problem was by picking up another fifth of the problem. It was obvious to them that I was in trouble, and I couldn't see it. And therefore, it's my opinion today that my illness is in me. My alcoholism is in me. It's not in the bottle. It has nothing to do with my wife complaining, the highway patrol, the penal system, or lawyers. And the first reason I believe that my illness is in me is because I have not had an alcohol problem since February 1st of 1981. Now, the primary reason for that is I have not drank alcohol since February 1st of 1981. Now, see, I don't like dogs. Well, see, I have never had a dog problem because I stay away from dogs. I spent a lot of time in Oklahoma, but you know, I never developed a rattlesnake problem. I stay away from rattlesnakes. See, it became apparent to me through these old guys that alcohol doesn't bother me until I bother it. It's not like it's laying up under my bed. And I get up to go use the bathroom at 3 o'clock in the morning, it trips me and jumps on my back. It's not like it's hiding in the back seat of my car. I get out to go to work, it jumps up there, chokes me, gets me drunk. I can't go to work. Usually I go get it. My problem is in here. Willard P. Willard P., an old friend of mine in Greensboro, used to say, "Dennis, this is an inside job." He said, "What is he talking about?" Finally, I begin to understand. The other reason I believe that my illness is in me is because these old guys did what the big book suggests that it did for several other people, the early members of Alcoholics Anonymous. They outlined a program of action for me. And back then, they just didn't say, "Don't drink and go to meetings." They said, "Don't drink," and they told you exactly what meetings to go to. And then they show up asleep in those meetings too. You know. And they suggested that I go to at least four speaker meetings a week. They allowed me to go to one discussion meeting a week. Four speaker meetings, one discussion meeting. I just did it. But I realize now that the reason I needed those speaker meetings is because I needed to hear how it was, what happened, and how it is today. I needed to hear the whole miracle. I needed to hear the whole miracle. And that's what I heard. And I remember going to that discussion meeting. I bought me a big book in the 12 and 12, and I was loaded, man. I wanted to share some wisdom. And they were so kind to me. They quit asking me questions when I said something dumb. They just show it to me in the book and keep right on going. They never exposed me. And the miracle began to happen. And see, what happened is, I didn't like being in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't understand a whole lot in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't understand sponsorship. I didn't understand these steps. But as I began to listen to people share the miracle of their sobriety, I began to know that I belonged in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I had felt like you felt. I had thought like you thought. I had drank like you drank. I knew that I belonged. I identified with the condition described. Now, I didn't know what to do about it. But I knew I belonged in Alcoholics Anonymous. And as they began to love me, I began to reflect back and remember the miracle of my life that I'm going to share with you tonight. I was born on a 13-acre cotton farm up in Cleveland County, North Carolina. I felt awkward then, and I felt awkward for the most of my life. I was ashamed of picking cotton. I don't know why. Everybody else had cotton, but I was ashamed of picking cotton. And then I had five sisters eventually, and I had three of these sisters before my brother came along. And I just never felt comfortable. These sisters, and I realize now that they really loved me. But they knew I was just a little different. First of all, I was a boy. Then I was a nosy little vulnerable boy. Stayed in trouble all the time. And some of it wasn't my fault. You know, they'd paint their fingernails on Saturday night to go to church. And I'm standing there looking dumb. I guess they'd say, but what they would say is, Dennis, boys don't paint their fingernails. I said, that's right, I understand that. And they said, but they do paint their thumbnails. I said, do it to me. And then, to make me look better, Dad was superintendent of Sunday school for the first 13 years of my life. One of the things I am most grateful for is the spiritual training that I received at an early age. I think it did a lot to prepare me for Alcoholics Anonymous. I really did. We go, Dad was just too cheap to pay for a whole first class haircut. Dad had some of those cheap Sears and Roebuck clippers. And Dad was old country boy. Dad's hand was so big it wouldn't even close to squeeze those clippers. And I was in the Army before I knew haircuts wasn't supposed to hurt. You know, they've been pulling, pulling my hair out all this time. And he just never could get it right. So here I am, you know, he'd get one side thin, the other side thick. And Mom was so proud of him. Mom had no brothers. She only had one uncle, and he died when I was real young. So on that side of the family, I was the first male in a long time. And she was so proud of him. She'd come by and say, Elgin, why don't you put a part in his hair? Well, Dad put one in there. Most of the time it'd be crooked, you know. And he said, Elgin, that was crooked. He just put another one in beside it, you know. And then, on top of that, I started wearing glasses when I was 5 years old. I'm the only little black kid in the first grade with glasses on. Welfare glasses. The old kind with the hook handle and the brown frame. You know, I had an eye that eyelid I have no control over. I look up, it look back down. I look that way, it look back over here. Yeah, I used to do it bad when I got drunk, too. Matter of fact, I used to... I get in a lot of fights like that. I get drunk and they say, man, who are you looking at? That's nobody. I'm not looking at nobody. So here I am, I'm only 6 years old. And I look like a weirdo and I feel like a weirdo. I'm sitting in Sunday school with two red thumbnails. A one-sided haircut and these welfare glasses. Now, top of all that, here I am born self-conscious. And I've always felt inferior, inadequate, like I just never quite measured up. And I felt like that for a long time. As I begin to grow up, you know, the beautiful thing I like about Shelby, North Carolina is the racial climate back then. You know, I was 12 or 13 years old before I realized I was supposed to hate white people. You know, but back then, everybody was so poor that you picked cotton in the same cotton field. You rode on the back of the same truck to pick up. And then when you got out of church on Sunday, you played in the same yard, climbed the same muscadine tree. I remember the school's integrated. When we were about 12 or 13 years old, and our last year in a segregated school, I began to feel different again. See, they had an end of the school party that year, and that was our last year together in that segregated school, and I noticed that I could not talk to the girls like the other guys talked to the girls. The black guys from Colley Oak Park had cool walks. They dipped a little bit when they walked. I didn't do that. And I didn't know how to do that, see that. And I think what had happened is I'd been pulling that cotton sack for 13 years and it took the dip out of my head. And these guys could dance and I couldn't dance. As a matter of fact, I couldn't even understand the music. They were listening to Martha Reeves and the Vandellas, Tammy Terrell, and the Supremes, Marvin Gaye. I hadn't heard any of that stuff. I'd been laying in the bathtub on Saturday night listening to a country western station out of Gaffney, South Carolina. You know, I knew about Buck and the Buckaroos and Conway Twitty and the Twitty Birds. And Merle Haggard and the Strangers. You know, that sounded like a group I might even fit in. You know? And so here I am. I'm 13 years old. I'm afraid of interacting with my white friends because I don't want to be rejected by my black friends and vice versa. And then to top it all off, I'm a soul brother and I don't have soul. And I'm black and I ain't cool. But I found something that summer that would do the trick. It was in my wife's grandfather's corn crib. I think it was a bottle of Old Crow. And me and my friend Kale laid up in the barn out there after we found Grandpa's liquor and we drunk Grandpa's liquor. And you know, my whole world changed right out there in that corn crib. I felt those glasses straighten up on my face. As a matter of fact, after a while, I didn't even need them. I told Kale, I said, Kale, I told Kale, I said, Kale, I got this 20/20 vision, I think. I'm seeing two of everything here. And I've missed a lot up until now. And Kale and I went down the hill, and we laid up on the plum bushes and talked about what we'd do to those Brentley girls. They came along, and they didn't come. We didn't get to do it. We went on back up and hid in the corn crib, and we knew that Grandpa was going to come out for his Saturday afternoon honk, you know. And we were being raised in the Baptist church. You knew that if you took anything, you had to give it back, and we did. We urinated in the bottle and hit it right back where we found it. I always tell people, you know, I've been in the recycling a long time, you know. I just wanted to use it. I didn't want to keep it, you know. And, you know, I never got caught for that. But, you know, I knew I wanted that feeling again. that summer I tried to make some wine of my own. And I got some berries out of the backyard and I boiled them. And at that time, you know, I was getting pretty big. I couldn't fight, but I could scare people, you know. And I scared these girls into not telling it. And I boiled up this stuff and got it in two mason jars. And I knew it was supposed to ferment. Because it fermented and alcohol would get in it. And it had to be in the dark somewhere, you know. I don't know about making wine now. I couldn't make none then, but I made some. And the darkest place I knew was a hole in the backyard. And I buried that stuff in a hole in the backyard and went and sat on the back porch about 5 minutes. Drank that first one and it did absolutely nothing. I poured a little rubbing alcohol in the next one. And drank it sometime later and gave me the worst case of gas I ever had. But, you know, I'm looking for that feeling again, and I'm only 14 years old. I had no idea I could play basketball, had no idea I was capable of doing college-level work. It never occurred to me that I had never studied in school. As soon as they got some glasses that I could see out of, I could do school work with no problem. But my high school transcript is consistent throughout the whole 12 years of school. Said stuff like, Dennis is a nice kid. He gets along well with us. Dennis is smart. He can do the work, but he won't do the work. And see, I didn't get lazy after I started drinking. I was lazy a long time before I started drinking. I didn't start lying after I started drinking. I have always just been naturally dishonest. I don't know why that is. It just is. You see, I remember coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wanted what you had so badly. Your shirt tail was in, you were clean shaven, and you smelled good, and you hugged me, and I wanted that, but I wasn't willing to work for it. Didn't want to do it. I see, I went through school. I wanted the easy teachers, but you don't learn a lot with the easy teachers. I have never wanted to do the work. I'm just naturally lazy. But when I entered high school, I entered high school on a college preparatory track and involved in an athletic program, basketball specifically. That was before I gained all this weight. And I began to drink myself out of everything, unknowingly. The only thing I knew in high school is that alcohol seemed to do me just a little bit differently than it did other people. And therefore, I drank myself off a school bus route in a year and 19 days, and I drank myself out of the athletic program, in 2 years. And I remember entering high school on a college preparatory track, dropping from that to general, from that to vocational, and barely slid out, begging teachers to pass me. I might add that I was born and raised between two sisters who were each skipped a grade in school. I just never wanted to do the work. Never wanted to follow instructions. By the time I got out of high school, I was mad at everybody. I was mad at my parents because they wanted to love me. They wanted to give me the same things that any responsible parent would give their kids. Wanted me to get an education. Wanted me to have some good, fit spiritual life. Wanted me to treat the ladies respectably and come in at a reasonable hour and quit crawling in the bathroom drunk. And I hated them for it. And I started another pattern, getting even with you by punishing me, and I joined the Army. I'll show them. Right in the middle of the Vietnam War, in 1971, I joined the Army. That's right. And I came home, and Dad was sitting on the front porch, smoking my cigarettes. He always did that. Dad knows nothing about alcoholism, didn't know anything about anything. He just... Anyway, we start smoking, he starts smoking. We move out, he quit smoking. But I said, Dad, I joined the Army. He said, that's good, you ain't doing nothing else, go tell your mom. And that's who I wanted to tell anyway. Mom wanted me to do stuff like take typing in high school. And here I am now, I'm the two-finger computer expert. Still suffering from not following instructions. And I knew Mom was going to get nervous and fidgety and start crying and hollering. I said, Mom, I joined the Army. She said, Dennis, no, you didn't. So I peeled out the papers. Man, she started crying and hollering and rolling all over that bed. I said, man, I finally got her back. Teach them to mess with me. That's right. 2 weeks later, I was down at Fort Jackson crying, hollering, rolling all over my bed. And did that a lot. You know, I stayed in the Army 8 years and hid from society for 8 years. I'm quite sure had I been on the street and been available to law enforcement officers, I guarantee you I would have had serious trouble. I accumulated 5 DWIs over that 8 years, and I was always reprimanded by the Army, punished by the Army, shipped to Germany. I was never convicted of a DWI. My denial system told me, if you didn't get convicted, then you didn't do it. I said, that's right. Coming back from Vietnam, I realized that I was drinking heavily. I had begun to drink wine. And you know, even today, winos have a special place in my heart. I like a good old wino talk. You know what I'm talking about? It makes me feel my allegiance. As a matter of fact, I have been known just to stand up in the back of the room, put my hand over my heart. You know, it's dear to me. You know, and I had begun to drink wine. I'm not talking about the good stuff. I'm talking about Night Train and Thunderbird and Mad Dog. You know, I just drink a single bit. And I drank like that until the end of my drink. I remember getting off the plane from Germany in 1977. My wife and 2 kids had been out there, and I mean, we'd been in Germany for 42 months. And during that time, we had paid off all of our bills, except I had a bad habit of ordering those brand new Pontiacs. And they seemed to, I used to wonder how I got all those DWIs. Man, these Pontiacs would have the rubber straps on the back and the fender skirts and the silver and red interior. They knew it was a drunk car when they seen it, you know. And anyway, we went out to Oklahoma to do my last tour. I had been selected for drill sergeant status for my last 2 years. And I didn't know at that time it would be my last 2 years. And in that 2 years, my alcoholism progressed to the point that my marriage went to shambles. My military career fell apart. I was actually up to my neck in debt. So I was levied for career. I guess the Army wanted to get rid of me for a little while, and Libra would love that tour. She wanted to get rid of me too. And the last thing I'm going to do is what you want to do, so I decided to get out. And we got out, and Libra moved back to Shelby, North Carolina, and I went out to do my last 45 days in the Army. And that last 45 days, I began to drink with authority. I drank like I wanted to drink. And with those wife and kids gone and drinking like I want to drink, I found out some things about my life. I found out that I was just as miserable by myself as I was with her with me. I began to suspect that the problem might be an inside job, like Willard said. I began to wake up in places I had never been with people I didn't know. I barely escaped foreclosure on that house. I salvaged $3,300 out of a $21,000 house. And I woke up out of what I later became known as my first blackout that I understood. Driving that car around on the edge of a wheat field, and I was absolutely broke. I remember sending Libra home $1,300 of that money. And I cannot tell you what happened to the rest of the money. I do not know. And that was the basis for many an argument until we were well grounded in AA and Al-Anon, because I knew nothing of blackouts. So I came back in North Carolina like a good drunk supposed to, drinking wine and writing bad checks. Libra had a house in Greensboro, and after some discussion about where that money was, I didn't know anything about, she said, well, I'm going anyway, I got a house in Greensboro. And she moved to Greensboro, North Carolina, and like a good drunk, I got another car and followed me, you know. Libra got a work job at Seller Anton's. I would apply for one job a day. I mean, if they didn't hire me, my next stop was a liquor store. I didn't have time to be waiting for these people to hire me, you know. And I drank for 2 more years after that. And eventually I was hired in a local prison unit. And that's when I began to see the other side of me. Come in drunk on first shift. They put me on second shift. Come in drunk on second shift. They put me on third shift. And just before I was promoted to fourth shift, the miracle began to happen. I was invited home Thanksgiving of 1980 for a Thanksgiving dinner. And I didn't know at the time, but they had begun to discuss, what are we going to do about Dennis? Can we get him in a VA hospital? Ain't something we can do about this boy. And they asked me something about church. And while I had their attention there, I gave them all a good cussing. And if you're going to win arguments like that, you got to leave. And I did, and I woke up out of what I know is my second recognizable blackout in a place called Kannapolis, North Carolina, trying to drive back to Greensboro. And that drive was the most miserable drive I'd had in a long time. It seems like everything I'd been told of alcoholism, I remembered it then. See, in 1976, when I got one of these DWIs, we got a letter from home telling us that Libra's uncle had gotten sober in this strange thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. He didn't drink anymore. And I began to suspect that these people were after me. See, they were anonymous. You didn't know when they were around. See, so now I got to dodge the Highway Patrol, the Army, and Libra. And these Alcoholics Anonymous people. So that Sunday, one of the first miracles happened. I had said, when I get home, I'm going to call Dan. I got home, I said, I ain't calling Dan because I quit. Quitting for good. Dan called me. Dan asked me, could he come by? And Dan came by. And Dan parked himself on my couch. I began to go outside and look around in his car, and I saw a big faded out book in the back of his car. It had Alcoholics Anonymous on it. I tried to steal Dan's book. His car was locked. And I went back inside. I said, Dan, tell me about this thing called alcoholism. And Dan talked for what seemed like 2 hours. And finally Dan said, Dennis, if I dial a number, will you talk? I said, Dan, if you just shut up, I'll talk. It ain't no fun punishing yourself. And I talked to another guy that said he was an alcoholic on the phone. His name was James. He wanted me to be in his office Monday morning at 9 o'clock, and I went down there and I talked to James. James was a strange-looking guy. He was a black guy, clean-shaven, had a nice, neat haircut. His socks and his pants matched. He had starch in his shirt and a necktie on. I hadn't been around people dressed like that in a long time. I didn't trust him. And he talked freely about his alcoholism. And I took a little test and had 20 questions on it. I made 100 on the test. Man, I tell you, I had never been around anybody that talked about themselves like that. He talked about being locked up, neglecting his wife, abusing his kids. Man, I don't know about you guys, but I'm a good Southern Baptist. Now, I tell it on you, but I ain't telling it on me. No. I wanted out of there badly. And on my way out the door, a little lady named Ray, well, first of all, James said, Dennis, if you're going to stay sober, you're going to need this. And he had one of those brand new books, the blue and white cover on it, just glowing. And that's what I wanted, so I could go home and work this program in my bedroom and I have to make meetings like y'all. I felt sorry for you, but I just wasn't that bad. And then James asked me another question. He said, Dennis, do you think your wife and your children will come into counseling? I said, oh, man, I knew they would. I didn't want them to. They done messed up my drinking, now they're going to mess up my not drinking. And see, Dennis and Michelle were just, I think they were 6 and 8 then. 6 and 8. And see, you have to watch kids when they're young. If you're not careful, they'll tell the truth on you. You don't want them to. You don't want them telling the truth on you, you know. And so the kids went to a little counseling. Libra went just right into counseling and right on into Al-Anon. Got kind of feisty, you know. She say stuff like, Dennis, I'm going to an Al-Anon meeting tonight. And if you want to go to an AA meeting, and you make arrangements for the kids or take them with you, it's about time you do that. You're their father. Wouldn't even discuss it. And then, no argument. And then she'd go jump in that big Pontiac and leave. And leave. I'd have to drive that little Volkswagen that I'd wrecked 3 times. And you know, and it's uncool for a man of my stature. Have to drive that Volkswagen with the mashed in nose, you know. So, sometime later on, she came in and said, Dennis, I am going to an Al-Anon retreat down at Bonnie Doon's. I said, Libra, how much does that cost? And she told me. I said, Libra, we can't afford that. She said, I can't afford not to, and left. You know, no discussion. So I started coming around these AA meetings. Sitting at the back. If you had any donuts or cookies, I'd sit near them. And my memory started coming back a little bit. I began to feel sorry for y'all. You know, powerless over alcohol in your life has become unimaginable. I said, what's wrong with these people? They can't drink liquor. I couldn't take that step. See, I was powerless over bill collectors. I was powerless over the highway patrol. I was powerless over Libra's mouth. I was not powerless over alcohol. You know, it never occurred to me that at this time I was bankrupt. Just before filing. And my wedges were garnished for my first 21 months sober. And I couldn't see that my life was unmanageable. I couldn't take step two. Because I could not see the insanity of my behavior. I couldn't see the insanity of my drinking. How can I be restored to something that I already got? I wasn't about to mess with step three because it had God in it. Me and him hadn't cut a deal in so long. You see, my concept of God had changed. I knew it was just a while. He's just sitting up there with the big fly swatter, and just a while, he's going to catch me running from one bootlegger to the other, and pap, that'd be it for me. And I started on step four, you know. I don't know about you, but I knew a whole lot more about step four than I did step one when I started, and so I just started where I knew. And I started writing a novel. I heard y'all talk about it around these discussion meetings, and you know, it was really good stuff. I thought maybe I might make a little money off that. And somebody had mentioned sponsorship for me to me, and Margaret. Margaret didn't even have a problem with alcohol, but she was concerned about Dennis. And she talked to me many times about sponsorship. But I couldn't find anybody to sponsor me. I couldn't find anybody black enough. Couldn't find anybody cool enough. Couldn't find anybody tall enough. Couldn't find a Vietnam veteran. I saw a couple of women I thought might make good spots. I said, I'm beside them. They get up, you know. So if you can't find good sponsorship, you know what I had to do. I had to sponsor myself. If you're having problems with your program, if you're having problems with people loving you, sponsor yourself for them. It turned out to be good for me. I sponsored myself for 81 days. Counted every one of them, too. I tell you, never been so miserable with me in my life. But see, the good thing about that sponsoring yourself is you don't have to make phone calls because you're already there. You don't have to go to discussion meetings. As a matter of fact, you don't have to go to meetings. Just sit at home. Just do a little meditation. You don't have to read the big book. See, when you're sponsoring yourself, life is good. I sponsored myself for 81 days, and all of a sudden, you know, I had a brain attack, you know. I'm a drunk. I've never had a heart attack, but I've had a lot of brain attacks. And usually after I have one, I end up somewhere drunk. And I had the idea that since I could not drink, maybe there were some other substances I could use as substitutes. And I did. And I ended up in a place called Spindale, North Carolina, and that's about 150 miles from home. And somehow I had lost most of my clothes, you know. And that was my last drum. Just me and my sponsor up there half naked. You know? That Sunday, my baby sister drove me back home. She was going to college nearby. And I drove all of that stuff. Riding, she drove. For some reason, that drunk just seemed to be different from any before. I couldn't drive. Another thing that I couldn't do is I couldn't think of a lie good enough to tell you. And that Monday, I did the only thing I believe I have done absolutely right since I've been associated with Alcoholics Anonymous. I came back. And the old grease spot boys were still back. They said, "We've been saving a seat for you." Man, I hated that. And they talked to me that night after the meeting in a language that I understood. You see, I learned that when they don't have your insurance money and they ain't got your mom and daddy's money, and you ain't living in their center, they can talk to you in a language that you understand. And when I left there that night, I had the basis for my recovery. I remember James asking me about prayer and meditation. He said, "Boy, did you pray the day that you drank?" For some reason, I answered him. I just said no. That was the first time that I had told the truth in a long time. And you know, the truth usually doesn't take a whole lot. It's just no, and that was it. That felt so good because I didn't have to worry about what lie I was going to tell to cover that one up. And he said, "Boy, how do you expect to stay sober if you don't use this program, the people in it, and a power greater than yourself? See that you can't keep yourself sober." When I left that meeting that night, I had the basis for my recovery. I had the same thoughts that went through my head this morning when I got up. I knew that Dennis Nance could not keep Dennis Nance sober. I knew that night, and I knew this morning, that Dennis Nance cannot replace alcohol with any mood-altering chemical. I knew that night and this morning that Dennis Nance was going to have to effect some type of relationship with God as he understood him or as he misunderstood him. And that Dennis Nance was going to have to follow instructions from someone, some sponsor, that was reasonably sober and was reasonably successful at living this program and staying sober a day at a time. Now, I didn't like a bit of that, but I started praying that night. I didn't like praying. I went home, and I had my bathroom prayers. I sneak in the bathroom, flush the commode, turn some water in the sink, run a little water in the shower, say, "God, thank you for keeping me sober, cut all that water off and go to bed." But I didn't want anybody to know that I was praying. I didn't want anybody to know that I was so uncool that I couldn't stay sober by myself. And I did that for about 6 months. They appointed me a sponsor, gave me Ivy. Ivy was unemployed, unemployable, living with his mother, been married twice, divorced twice, and his last drunk was on wintergreen alcohol. I said, "Man, this guy's crazy. That's why you got him." He wouldn't let me complain about Libra. He wouldn't let me complain about anything. Ivy worked with me through the first three steps, and he sent me over to Lou. Lou worked with me from steps 4 through 9. And then they sent me to AD. AD said, "Dennis, we're on step 1. And we went back through the steps. But AD would let me complain about Libra. I complained about my wife. Said she's going to those Al-Anon retreats, won't treat me right. And he'd take me on little tours through his apartment. Open the bathroom. See anybody in there? Nope. Go to the next bedroom. Anybody in there? Nope. He said, "Boy, it's lonely living by yourself. Let's go talk about the books. Set me down in the bedroom." AD began to do, and AD did the most loving thing I think one drunk can do for another. AD taught me what he knew of the first 164 pages of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He taught me what he knew of the program and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. AD talked to me about prayer. he talked with me about how to treat my family. I remember one night he just told my wife flat out, said, boy, he said, Libra, if this boy gives you any trouble, you give me a call. I said, man, what is he going to do? What can a 72-year-old man do to a young 27-year-old man like me? Then all of a sudden the thought occurred to me, you know, this guy might call GSO and have my sobriety revoked, so I better go to the jail, you know. It's rough out there, you know. But AD required that I give something back. He required that I become active in the meetings. He required that I read. He required that I chair meetings. He required, you know, that I sponsor other people or do what I could to help other people. And back then, they would come and pick you up and take you on 12-step calls. He required that I go to the Florida street apartments and chase drunks. He required that I get on the answering service. I was sober 9 years in Greensboro, and I was transferred to Charlotte. The family had begun to change. My kids had grown in and through Alateen. Libra had become well-grounded in alcoholics in Al-Anon. And I believe that Alateen and Al-Anon and Alcoholics Anonymous do the same thing for families and individuals that the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous do for alcoholics. They rebuild the human heart and mind from the inside out. And I am so grateful to have that support of Al-Anon and Alateen. It certainly has made a difference with our kids. By the way, Dennis is 25 now. I think he's too cool for Alateen or Al-Anon right now. I think someday they'll be back. Dennis is married, but I think he's going to be divorced shortly. Has three beautiful daughters, my granddaughters. And I have to be careful what I tell them because they've never seen Pawpaw drunk. And they think that what I say is the gospel. I understand that. Because I thought that one time. You know. But they're the loves of my life, and the truth is, I am absolutely no good for them. Some way I'll find a way to give them what they want. I know that's not good. Michelle, I think Michelle's finishing her last year of college. And she's doing her relationships about like I done my drinking. She ain't real good at them. I think eventually she'll quit. But the 4th of July, we had all of them down. It's kind of like having the family back together again, and I really did enjoy that. Libra has, she's just been the love of my life. And I'm finally getting to a point where I think I can express love in a healthy way. And, I've decided that I don't think I'm going to move anymore unless she wants to move. It's just, she's just been through a lot. I'm in Easley, South Carolina now, third city I've lived in sober. These guys love me down there, too. Let me tell you what they do. I got me a sponsor. I just moved in and got me a sponsor. I found Sterling W. calling him to, look, man, I need sponsorship, and sponsorship is you. And we started getting together at lunchtime. And old Sterling started loving me. He started requiring that I make a little coffee, that I go down to the Salvation Army on Monday nights and help them get that group off the ground. He's volunteered me to chair meetings, whether I wanted to or not. Let me pick up cigarette butts. Say, you don't have to smoke. You can pick them up. They're nice to me. They love me like that. They love me like that. You know, the last 2 years I went back and completed a degree in behavioral science and psychology. And it just took me until I'm almost 44 years old to complete that degree. But I know this. There is a feeling, sitting there waiting for graduation, looking at my granddaughters wave at me from the upper deck, not really wanting to be there, but realizing, had it not been for the gift of sobriety that was brought to me by people like you, none of that would have been possible. See, I realize now that I walked around a long time looking for God in burning bushes, lightning bolts, and resounding voices. God came to me in the most effective means possible. God came to me in the most loving way possible. God came to me in the form of another drunk bearing the message of hope. I realize now that my prayers have always been answered. I have always sat in the middle of the solution, complaining about the problem. Those early years of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm 27 years old. I'm firmly convinced that I'll be the only black guy on my side of town that's not drinking wine on Saturday night. And I hated it. What am I ever going to do about fun? Why do I have to go to these meetings? Why do I got to sponsor people? Why do I got to go on 12-step calls? Why do I have to chair meetings? Other people are not doing what their sponsors say. Why I got to do this? I just felt sorry for me because I couldn't drink. And I sat right in the middle of the solution and complained about the problem and just wasted a lot of time. I think today about people with other illnesses. Liver disease, inoperable cancer, brain tumors, AIDS. If these people had a program of recovery, if all they had to do was work the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous a day at a time, if they were given the choice of getting their own sponsor, utilizing their concept of a higher power, if all they had to do was help other people that were recovering from terminal illnesses, if all they had to do was get a sponsor, if all they were asked to do were the things that I've asked to do, you couldn't find a meeting place to hold them all. And then I think about all the time that I spent in the middle of the solution complaining about the problem. And I think that says a whole lot about why I need to be here with you this weekend. I look forward to a great roundup now that my part's over with. Thank you all, and God bless.